Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools.
I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Talk about privacy and data all the time on the show, but let's dive into misinformation and fake news. Jordan Bitterman with Triple Lift, who's in the ad space, gives us his insights into what he thinks needs to change. This is a bonus episode of The Business of Tech. Your PR team did a great job and the pitch got my attention. So I'll tell my audience what interested me here was you've got a passion for managing misinformation and helping sites not promote it. That's a hot button issue that we know from big tech, right? And we know that a lot of big tech sites are under fire for this. But what's your thinking on the problem and how we should take it on? Give me your definition.
So misinformation, we can also probably talk about fake news and hate speech. They're all kind of slightly different ideas, but they're very much related. And what I would say is, let's go back a few decades before the internet. If a newspaper or a radio station was peddling in misinformation, they'd be held accountable by the government or by their audiences. And there were defined standards of truth. But today, those lines have been completely blurred. And with the government allowing for more and more self-regulation, and with audiences being increasingly polarized, as we see across the board all the time, these sites now operate out in the open. So a site can now, you know, report, quote unquote, on how Bill Gates is injecting people with microchips. And not only does the content stay live, but people embrace it. And there are untold thousands of websites that exist and do this way. And the way they stay in business in most cases is through ad revenue. And unfortunately, programmatic ad revenue, which is the part of the business that we operate in, is where they generate most of those dollars. And the reason why is because they don't normally hire sales teams. They're not big enough to hire sales teams. So they tap into what's known as programmatic advertising to help them drive revenue. And it's actually pretty easy to set up and do. And so you can start to generate money as a misinformation site. And obviously they don't position themselves as a misinformation site, but as a site that, you know, more or less delivers misinformation. And most advertisers obviously hate this because they earmark a percentage of their dollars to be spent in programmatic. And then a percentage of that programmatic spend gets spent on these types of sites. Now, it's not a huge amount, as I said before, but it is something. And so what happens is that consumers and watchdog groups, they'll go to those sites and they'll see it there. And all of a sudden now the brand has responsibility in all of that. So the responsibility now falls on the media buyer, either at a brand or at an agency, to decide what's real news and what's fake news. And that just shouldn't be their job.
Okay. So that's some fair thinking. And you're in the business of helping with buys and helping with people make those decisions. But isn't the incentive to get eyeballs, and isn't any way you can get eyeballs there a good thing, and why this is happening, right? Because we know outrage, engagement, they drive attention. So isn't the incentive the problem? Why wouldn't the buyer be incentivized to buy?
No, the buyer isn't incentivized, but the seller absolutely is, right? So if you've set up a site and it's all about rage, to your point, you're in the right business right now, or this is the right time for your business, because you're in this sort of vacuum in between truth and when we as a society get our act together and decide to stamp that out. But the buyer doesn't necessarily have incentive to do that, because look, we're all over the web as consumers. You, me, as audience members, your listeners, we consume a lot of content every single day. So there's plenty of what we call eyeballs to go around. As a brand, you don't want to find yourself advertising in front of the wrong eyeballs, because while I think to your question, the people who are consuming it might feel okay with that, like, that's all right. You know, if the audience is there, they're there for a reason. There are these watchdog groups and other consumers who will go check out to see, oh, so-and-so brand is there, this car company is there, this financial services company. And that's not a good thing if they know that you're monetizing hate speech.
Okay, so let me push on. I'm going to throw out a premise, and you tell me if I'm right or I'm wrong. So my basic premise here would be, sure, I get this as a theoretical risk, but I don't necessarily believe that brands or companies are going to pay a long-term price for doing this. I don't think they are. Am I right? Am I wrong?
Well, we live in a very polarized society. And so, you know, the calculus there may be that certainly you lose $20 here, maybe you make $20 over here. The people who are interested in that content might follow you there, and that's okay. But that's not in essence what brands desperately want to avoid. Is this idea of negative association or negative press. And very often what happens is that their brand is found to be running on a site that isn't completely on the up and up. There becomes an outcry over that. And they wind up spending a couple of spins in the news cycle trying to focus the attention back off of the fact that they were there or that they were monetizing that, as opposed to selling coffee or selling cars.
Sure. Okay. So some of your argument is it's a distraction. It's a money loss for this. I guess what I'm looking at is there also data from your perspective or that you've looked into that sort of shows that by doing this, you're aligning with a more lucrative buyer or more targeted, but like is doing this kind of more of an upside by being managed on this?
No, there's tons of data that run through the media industry. So we're never at a loss of having good data to make sure that we're reaching, you know, men 25 plus or, you know, people who love working out in gyms. We have all that information. Most of these sites that we're talking about aren't really measured by a lot of those same numbers anyway. So you don't necessarily even know what you're getting in that. You're just buying efficient inventory, efficient impressions, and you happen to be running in spill some of those impressions on sites that you might not want to be on or are unsavory in some way.
So one of the things that you mentioned as we were thinking this through and prepping, right, was that buyers need to take actions as well as publishers and no longer work with sites that promote that misinformation. Is there particular guidance that you're giving to those that are doing ad buys specifically?
Well, so what's happened for a long time is there's these what's known in our industry as inclusion and exclusion lists. And so back in the day, let's go back 20 years or so, when you would make a buy, you almost always made a buy on exactly the sites you wanted to run on. I want to run on AOL. I want to run on Yahoo, to pick a couple of sites of that day. Then what happened was the term exclusion lists came up. And the idea was, I don't want to run on this site. I don't want to run on that site. Now, a lot of times what those sites were straight news sites. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on, whether it's the New York Times, the Washington Post, Fox News, or the Wall Street Journal, a lot of those sites made their way onto exclusion lists because the buyer didn't want to run next to news that they couldn't control. You can run in sports, you can run in entertainment. Yeah, certainly you couldn't control whether the team won or the personality won the award or not. But it was less unsavory or had a lesser chance of being unsavory. You weren't around death and destruction. That has sure. actually caused problems with the news industry, because what's happened is a lot of news sites have wound up on exclusion lists. And so when you talk about local newspapers or the websites of local newspapers going out of business, not being able to fund journalism, it's because in many cases, this has happened across the board, those dollars run on exclusion lists. So we tell our clients, run on news sites. News sites need us. It's part of the proper functioning of society. And by the way, it turns out it performs pretty well. There's good return on advertising spend on those types of sites. But make sure that you're working with the right SSP. We're called an SSP, a supply side platform, to make sure that you're removing the sites that really do deal in that kind of misinformation and hate speech.
Gotcha. Okay. And look, I will put for my own listeners, like, I of course have incredible biases here as a person who does a news show and also sells ads. Like, I would be, be completely hypocritical of me to say that I don't believe in some of that model. I'm with you on a lot of this. Now, help me make this tangible for smaller companies. So, like, a lot of the listeners that I have on this space are small to medium sized businesses that are the kinds that are doing a lot of their buys through, say, Google Ads or Facebook or those kinds of digital ads. What do they need to be thinking about when they're doing the ads? Because to a certain degree, you just put out an ad on Google, right? And then it drives a bunch of to a particular audience into a particular landing page. But I don't think a lot about where that goes. What do I need to be thinking about if I want to be diligent?
Well, I would not tell any of your listeners who are in that category not to run on the Googles and the Facebooks of the world. And the reason why is because it performs and it's easy. And I don't say that in an uncomplimentary way. It is easy as a smaller right. business to be able to run on those platforms. And there is a lot of value in the ease. So what I'm about to say does not detract from that. But there have been a lot of, most of the focus around misinformation, hate speech, fake news has been directed towards Google and Facebook and a few other platforms. And with good reason, because while the monetization may happen, let's take a website. I don't even know what website to name, but let's just take a website that is, let's call it misinformation.com. Not that it would ever be called that.
Sure. It's a great one. You and I have now started it to try to
exactly.
sign you out. Right?
So you running on misinformation.com is the worst thing you can do, because then you're literally funding dollars to what they do. Facebook, mm-hmm. for the most part, is not how misinformation.com makes money. Facebook is how misinformation.com drives traffic back to their site. And so Facebook has not done misinformation any favors, but running on Facebook doesn't mean you're supporting that as a smaller business. Now, Google has multiple parts of their business. Parts of their business is in driving traffic to misinformation.com, but part of it is another part of Google's business. Obviously, Google's in the cloud world, they're in the search business, they're in YouTube, they're in a lot of different places. But one of the business that they're in is monetizing these smaller sites. They're known as what's known as a DSP, a demand side platform. And so misinformation.com could be, and in many cases would be, funded by Google's DSP business. If you're a small business, you're not funding that on the other side of their business. But if you're in the media business, or if you're a big brand running on their platform, you do have to be conscious of that.
Oh, I see. Okay, gotcha. So to a certain degree, it's about which products you're buying from these advertising platforms to make sure that you're on in the right places. Now, one of the things we talk a lot about in very broad context here is the amplification of misinformation sites. What are you advising to your ad buyers to make sure that they aren't doing? Is it exclusion lists? Is it specific types? How do you make sure that they are good buyers?
And I'll sort of reframe that by saying, how do we make sure that they are covered and that they are not being put in a compromising position? Because that's part of what our role has become. Sure. So one of the things we've done recently, and I bring this out to your listeners because it's just an interesting sort of weed that's grown up in our industry. There's an entity called NewsGuard, and NewsGuard is nothing if not a ranking system for news organizations. And that doesn't mean that they're coming in and saying that, you know, that this kind of reporting is right or wrong. They don't get into that. It's not a right versus left thing. But what they do is they create a ranking system for news organizations, thousands of them, based around misinformation. Do they have a true editorial mission and an editorial desk? Do they issue retractions when they're wrong or when they're called out for potentially being wrong? Things of that nature. And there's a scoring system. We've taken those ranks and we use that ranking system to go out and proactively remove sites from our platform. And we've actually issued, you know, blog posts and we've talked about this in the trades. And we've asked other competitors of ours to do the exact same thing, because at the end of the day, removing sites from our platform is not a good short-term strategy to make money. It's a better long-term strategy if you believe that it'll be good in the long term. But it's not just good long-term for our business, it's good long-term for society. And so, you know, checking out NewsGuard, which any of your audience members could do right now anyhow on their website, is a really interesting way. It's an interesting tool that's popped up in our industry, because we can't be the arbiter all the time. It's impossible for us to do that. What is the difference between real news and fake news? Sometimes you know it when you see it, and other times it's a much more subtle kind of endeavor.
It's interesting you bring up NewsGuard, because it's actually a tool that I use. It's installed on all my browsers
as a consumer
of news. And as an aggregator of news, one of the things I do, of course, is report on stories and give commentary. I want to make sure that I'm looking at sources that are reputable, that have a particular standard in order to continue to give good information. So I'm using it as a consumer. So my kind of final question, I always like this. It's a great consultant question. I freely tell anybody who's listening they can steal this from me. I keep a magic wand.
Is that Harry Potter?
It is a Harry Potter.
Yeah.
So it's a Harry Potter magic wand. Now, the fun thing about the magic wand, of course, is you can cast magic wand and you can cast any wish that you'd like. Now, this one, of course, is restricted right now to only your industry. It is not as much fun. It cannot give us infinite money and it cannot give us infinite lives. But it could fix one thing around misinformation. What wish would you cast?
I wish we could go back. I wish we could combine both the technology that we have right now with the more black and white way that we looked at news and truth a few decades ago. And I know you said confine this to the industry, and I will for the most part, but it also speaks to us as consumers of information. It speaks to us at a societal level and what we can believe and what we can't believe. And it really, actually, even in the last few weeks, it's pained me more than ever. I mean, this is even past the last 4 or 5 years. that we don't have a way any longer of being arbiters of truth. We used to have op-ed boards or editorial boards for large institutions. We had the Walter Cronkites of the world, and we don't have that anymore. And so we're polarized as ever. There's no way I can have a conversation with someone, whether it's about my industry or whether it's about a topic, and be able to get always on the same page based on those shared truths.
It's a good wish, and I'll throw in my own bias to sort of close us out on this and get your thought on it, is I believe we're swinging back around on the value of content. I freely admit I'm betting my own career and livelihood on this because I believe there's value in curation, right? I believe that I have listeners, I believe, because I'm spending the time to curate news sources, provide that information. I provide perspective. I give commentary in my Why Do We Care segments. But the idea is to come through trusted sources, and that the curation has value. I'm open with my audience. It gets monetized by an advertising mechanism or direct listener support. And that's the way that it allows it. And I believe people are paying again for content. And it's interesting to hear your wish, because I believe there are ways of building businesses to solve that. I will be wishful thinking and think that somebody who's listening may decide to help invest in technology and create solutions to that pair the two, pair the technology with the human curation, because I think the two is where we've over-rotated. What do you think? Am I right or wrong?
I do believe you're right. That said, to date, we have seen that the experiments, so to speak, in this area have kind of failed. And you can look at Facebook as a perfect example of that, where they were sort of damned if they do, damned if they don't. They created this curation team, this editorial team. There have been a lot of non-starts with that, both from the perspective of the satisfaction of the employees in that group, as we've probably, and many of your listeners have probably read, but also just the efficacy of
it.
And so we've got a lot more work to do there. I think it's possible, but I think this is probably a decade-long issue to solve for. It's probably not a 12-month issue to solve for.
Well, I completely agree, and I'll use my quip on this. In mystery, there is margin.
Absolutely.
If it was easy, everyone would be doing it. But the things that are hard, that's where the money
is.
That's
where it's worth doing.
Well, Jordan, thanks for taking some time to talk
to me.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of The Business of Tech. Remember, if you like this kind of content, you can support it directly. Visit patreon.com/MSP Radio for our Give What You Want program. Every little bit helps, and we are supported directly by listeners like you. I'll talk to you again tomorrow.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.